It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. On January 15th, history was made in Pennsylvania when Kathleen Kane was sworn in as the first woman to be elected Attorney General in Pennsylvania and the first Democrat elected to the position since it became an elective office in 1980. In the now 3 months since she took office, Ms. Kane has wasted no time making her mark. She blocked a British company from expanding gambling in the governor's lottery privatization deal and ended the so-called Florida loophole that allowed rejected gun owners to get around Pennsylvania law on concealed carry permits. She is now in the process of weighing other even more controversial issues like the state's voter ID law as well as prosecuting criminals. She takes time out from her busy schedule to join us here in Studio A. Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And if you have a comment or question for our guest, you can email us at esspgh@wesa.fm. You can also reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. You made history as the first woman and the first Democrat to be elected Attorney General in Pennsylvania. What does that mean to you?
Well, it was very exciting. I will tell you that. When I first decided to run over 2 years ago, I did not know that I would be the first woman elected Attorney General, nor did I know that I would be the first Democrat elected Attorney General. And when my team told me that you would be the first woman elected, I said, you need to go back and check that because that seems impossible. It's 2010. We had to have elected a woman somewhere along the way. But what it means to me is a responsibility to make sure that we have women leaders. Women do offer a different perspective. And what we need is diverse voice in our government. Women offer a diverse voice. If you're only hearing from a certain section of the population, then you're not representing everyone. So I think women's voices in government are very important. And I know that along the way, and even now, women come up to me and say that they want to have me serve as a role model for their daughters or their granddaughters. And I'll tell you what, it's very humbling, number one. It's also a great responsibility to me that I take seriously. So I want to show them that you can do anything you want to do. Don't listen to the naysayers. Just keep forging ahead and you can find your dream. And then once you get your dream, you really make sure you need to get to work because someone just said, you know, I compare you to Jackie Robinson. He broke barriers, but once he got into the major leagues, he had to step up to the plate and hit the home run. So I do feel the same way. I don't rest upon the laurels that I'm the first woman or the first Democrat. I get to work and I do my job.
And you certainly have gotten to work, and we're going to get into some of the decisions that you've made just in these first few months of your tenure. But first, I'd like to ask you when you first became interested in the law.
I think I was around 7 years old. I have an uncle who is a lawyer, and I always found it fascinating that the law changes all the time, and it's always evolving, and it's changing with society to make rules and to make things better for other people. And I like rules. I like to know what our boundaries are and then act within them. I like to know that there are certain definitions that you have to act within. I like to know that there are rules of ethics and professional responsibility, which of course is totally different from a campaign where there are virtually no rules. But I love the law and I've always been interested in the law. And somewhere around, I was, I think, 12 or 13 years old, one of my first jobs was a CETA job, the city jobs for the low-income children. And I had to convert all of these criminal files onto microfilm. So it shows you how long that was. And I was fascinated by it. And then, unfortunately, one of my best friends, her father was murdered in cold blood. He was the president of the school board. He was on his way into a meeting, and he was murdered. And they never caught his killer after 30-some years. And that bothers me. So I think I also have a real sense of justice for people. I want to get it for them, and I want to find it for them. And that's something that drives me every day.
You received your law degree from Temple, and later from 1995 to 2007, you served as an assistant district attorney for Lackawanna County, where you prosecuted hundreds of sex abuse, elder abuse, murder, assault, rape, public corruption, fraud cases, you name it. Talk about what that experience was like and how it shaped you.
When I first began at the Lackawanna County District Attorney's Office, I came from a very large firm in Philadelphia. I had my own office, you know, great view, but it just didn't mean that much to me. I was 28 years old. I couldn't see myself getting up every morning and doing something that I didn't feel made a difference. So I cut my salary in half. I moved back to my hometown of Scranton, and I took that job. They immediately put me in the child sexual abuse and sexual abuse prosecution section. And they are the toughest, most heinous cases to prosecute. You're not dealing with a professional witness as you would in, say, a drug case or any other case. You're dealing with a child, and that child has had the worst event happen to them that they can imagine. And that event will stay with them for the rest of their lives. So as a prosecutor, the child needs to trust you so that they know that they're safe when you have them on the stand. They know that they're in your hands and they can tell their story. And that meant a tremendous amount to me. And I really then felt like this was the job for me. And I also made sure that the most vulnerable citizens in Pennsylvania were protected as well. I mean, when you take advantage of a child and you take advantage of our elderly or older Pennsylvanians who trust others, I think it's just pathetic. And we need to make sure that we're not only in there fighting, making sure that we have tough prosecutions, but that we go and teach them how not to become a victim. So not only did I prosecute, but I went into schools and senior centers. I went to senior citizens' homes to teach them about the latest and greatest scams out there, or to teach our kids what to look for and how to avoid becoming a victim of such a disgusting crime. And it was just an amazing job. I was out on the crime scenes with the police officers in the middle of the night. I was in the courtroom. I was in the appeals. And it's just so fulfilling. I can't even describe it to you. Other law enforcement officers will tell you that it is an addicting job.
You were a relative unknown when you decided to run for attorney general. What do you think were the factors that made people want to support you?
Well, relative unknown is an understatement. I think that what most people told me along the way is that they feel that I'm a real person. I am not a politician. I am a true prosecutor. And I didn't need the job. I'm not running because I wanted to seek higher office or I have an agenda, a professional agenda on my own. I ran because I love the law. I ran because I love being a prosecutor. And I think that that really translated everywhere I went on the campaign trail. And I traveled this state for over 2 years talking to large groups, small groups. And what they said was they felt like they can trust me to give them the facts, to find justice for them, and to not play politics with the lives of their children or their parents or their neighbors. And that is very important to me. We have to have prosecutions, not political motives.
How much do you think that the ads that really seem to stick with people, Kathleen Kane, she's tough on crime, how much did those help? Were they your idea?
No, they were not my idea. I like to insert my opinions to my media team, but it was their idea. And what they do is they spend a lot of time with you and they realize what your strengths and what your weaknesses are. And I think part of my strength was that I really did have the resume as a tough prosecutor. There was no one who could deny that. And people of Pennsylvania need to know that they have somebody tough looking out for them, that they have somebody who will march into that courtroom and demand justice for them. So that was part of what the ads tried to get across. And obviously, I think that they were well placed, but they also tried to get across that I am not a politician. I am not running for any other motive. I am running because I want to be their prosecutor.
When you were running for attorney general, you were endorsed by former President Bill Clinton. How did you get to know President Clinton?
I first met President Clinton. I volunteered for his wife, for Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign, presidential campaign. And she made a couple of visits to Scranton, and that's where I met President Clinton. And it's a great story of how I actually got his endorsement. It was Friday afternoon. We were sitting at my kitchen table where we worked out of, and I didn't have any endorsements. Virtually, there was no one backing me. So I said to my cousin, Google President Clinton's number. Let's get him on the phone. I'm going to ask for his endorsement. And she laughed and she said, only somebody from West Side would have the guts to call President Clinton to ask for his endorsement. So I called and I said, this is Kathleen Kane. I'd like to speak to the president. And the nice woman on the other end paused and she said, honey, you know I can't do that. I said, I know. Can you get a message to him? And she did. A week and a half later, somebody from his team called me back and they said, Yes, President Clinton remembers you. He knows your. He looked at your background. He understands what it is to be an attorney general because that was his first job, and he'd be very honored to support you. And from there, I think our friendship and our respect for each other grew even more. I just I couldn't thank him enough for all that he did for me.
He showed up here and made a personal appearance.
He did. He showed up for a rally in Philadelphia. He showed up in Scranton. He is a very loyal, I think, dedicated public servant, and I think that he knew that Pennsylvania needed just that, and I think that that's part of the reason why he backed me.
And you mentioned working on Hillary Clinton's campaign. In what ways has she inspired you as a pioneering woman yourself?
When you have to fill out questionnaires during the campaign, one of the biggest questions is well, who's your idol? And, you know, there's a lot of typical answers, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln. My idol really is Hillary Clinton. She is the perfect example of resilience, and she is always determined, and she is a really hard worker. She is very smart and very well-informed, but she really has a heart of gold. She is very compassionate towards other people and very warm. She remembered my children's names, and when she saw them, she said to them, Christopher and Zach, what your mother is doing to help shape this country is unmatchable in any other thing that she can do. And just to see the look on my children's face that somebody like Hillary Clinton would take the time out for that kind of a compliment, it was immeasurable. So I think that she also is a true public servant. I believe that in 2016, she will realize that if the country needs her, no matter how tired she is, she'll step up to the plate. And I think that we need more leaders like her.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest for this entire hour is Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. We'll continue our conversation with her when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest for this entire hour of the program is Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. We're taking your email questions at ESSPGH at WESA.FM, and you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at hashtag EPLive. In the wake of the Boston Marathon bombing, do you think Pennsylvania has the systems in place to deal with an act of terrorism?
I think that no state ever expects it to happen and, of course, never wants it to happen. But we do have those mechanisms in place. Yes, we do have an emergency plan. In fact, we started just a couple of weeks ago reviewing the emergency plan to make sure that it was up to date, make sure that we check with our federal partners, our local partners, to make sure that it is a plan that works with them as well. And it's something that we hope we never have to put into action, but we're ready if it is there, and we will always offer our assistance to whomever is handling the investigation.
Are there any protocols that you're looking at so there is a certainty and confidence on your part that we're as prepared as possible to investigate something of that magnitude?
Well, of course, communication is always very important between the different agencies that are investigating, whether it's ATF, FBI, local police, or the state police. And we need to make sure that everybody works together, everybody has the equipment necessary, and that we have the manpower. And I know that this state is filled with professionals. I think that we can feel safe knowing that if this does happen, that we will immediately respond and the response will be the best that it can be.
I know that your office is actively engaged in warning Pennsylvanians about potential scams for helping victims of the Boston Marathon bombings. Have you identified anything, any particular scam at this point?
Immediately, we had calls coming in about some scams that may have been occurring. And of course, we like to put it out into the public immediately so that they do not become the victims of the scam. And so that the public is also trusting in the fact that we will tell them who is legitimate and who is not, because we don't want to discourage them from giving in any means. What we want to make sure is that the money is going actually towards the victims or the cause that the generous people of Pennsylvania are putting it towards. So, yes, we did have some. We are checking them out now to confirm whether they are legitimate or not. They appeared from the outset not to be legitimate, that they were posting photos of children from the Boston Marathon and asking to give to a certain site, and we need to confirm that those sites are actually legitimate.
we had the new Turnpike CEO, Mark Compton, on the program talking about the scandal-plagued agency and the charges against six men as part of an alleged pay-to-play scheme. Turnpike employees who tried to blow the whistle on this were marginalized, punished, forced out. How concerned are you about the willingness of state employees in the wake of all this who want to be true to their moral obligation to step forward?
Well, I'm very concerned about it because in Pennsylvania, we do not have a whistleblower statute, and we desperately need that. That they are the informants who let law enforcement agencies know that there is corruption occurring and that millions upon millions of dollars are being stolen from the taxpayers. And they're on the inside. You know, we can't just go and subpoena records without probable cause that it's a crime is occurring. So we need to have those informants who give us the tips or who give us the information from the inside. And people also need to have an outlet to fulfill their moral responsibility. You know, they have families that they have to feed and they have careers that they have to watch over so that they can keep their homes. We need to give them a mechanism, a safe mechanism for which they can report crimes and make sure that they can keep their jobs and continue to feed their families.
As the revelation of all of this has come out over the last few months, how confident are you that this culture of corruption, which is deeper than I think anybody realized at first, can be eliminated?
I don't think it will ever be eliminated, but I think like any crime, the more that we prosecute, the more that we punish, the more that we investigate and stay on top of, it will be a deterrent to those who commit a crime. They will hopefully think to themselves, well, that $2,000 I got or that $7,000 gift I just received isn't worth losing your home, losing your family, losing your freedom. So we are like a dog on a bone when it comes to public corruption. It steals taxpayers' money. It destroys everyone's trust in their government, and that is wrong. And we will make sure that everywhere it goes, every road it takes us to, that we will prosecute, regardless of who the person is, how wide scale the crime is, or how small it is.
You mentioned early in our conversation about having a love for the law, and there is this deterrent that you just mentioned for people to take bribes, and that is that you can lose everything. But are there enough people serving in the state and in government who are concerned simply about integrity, about doing the right thing, that for whom there does not need to be a deterrent? Are there enough of those people serving?
That is a very subjective question that I wish I could give you an answer to, but I just can't. All I can tell you is that we're watching. And if anybody decides that it is in their best interest to get involved in public corruption, we will teach them otherwise. I hope so. I'll be honest with you. I hope that there are enough people in our government who feel that same way. And look, we have really good people. We have true public servants. And sometimes they get ruined because one apple does ruin the bunch. So we need to make sure that we get the laws in place that allow us to deter the activity, that allow us to investigate more thoroughly, because the more we can investigate and deter, the better off we'll be. But I sure hope that that's the case.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. Shortly after you were sworn in as Attorney General, your office began a review of how the Attorney General's office investigated the Jerry Sandusky case under then Attorney General and current Governor Tom Corbett. During your campaign, you were sharply critical of that investigation. Where do things stand with that review?
As you know, during the campaign and even thereafter, I have a lot of questions. So do many, many, many Pennsylvanians. They have a lot of questions, and we are going to answer those questions. Right now, we have hired a special deputy attorney general whose sole responsibility is to review that case, to investigate what happened. He is doing that. The investigation is proceeding along diligent lines. And I will tell you that once we feel that we have uncovered every stone and every piece of evidence and every fact that we can find, and once it is put together in a whole story and not just fragmented into sound bites or you know, just certain pieces of the story, once it is complete, then we will allow everyone to know what we have found, or quite frankly, if we didn't find anything at all. All my primary objective is to put forward the facts of what happened, just the facts.
This is, a difficult question to put to you, but I feel I must do it anyway. And that is, as you look back on how the investigation began, are there things that you're thinking you might have approached differently?
Well, this isn't anything that I haven't said before. I mean, I was a child abuse prosecutor, and I have never used a grand jury to investigate a child abuse case because of the expediency that you must take in getting a child predator off of the streets. So that was always one of my questions. Why was a grand jury used? Why did it take so long? And those are some of the questions that we hope to answer.
Have you set a deadline for completing the review?
No, and I will not set a deadline. I will not succumb to the pressures of the media or the public to get it done. I can tell you that we are proceeding on a good pace, but as soon as it's done, that's when it will be done, and I'm not going to rush it. I'm going to make sure that it is a complete factual report that is going to be submitted. And you know, I also know that these investigations, if you believe that there's 10,000 pages of documents and once you get in there, there's 100,000 pages of documents, that would throw off your timeline. So there is no timeline. When it is complete, it will be complete.
And what happens if you see any evidence of foot dragging?
Well, there won't be, because I am on top of this case, and the special prosecutor who was appointed special deputy attorney general is really good at what he does. He has a great reputation. He and I talk all the time about the pace of the investigation, the things that he's looking at, where to go to. I have a lot of input, and his office is right down the hall from mine, so I keep a good watch on the pace.
Another one of your first decisions was to block a British company from expanding gambling in the governor's lottery privatization deal on constitutional grounds. When you made that decision, the Republican Party of Pennsylvania said you were putting politics before people, citing the revenue the governor's lottery deal was designed to raise for seniors. What is your response to that criticism?
Well, first, the role of the Attorney General is to review the contract for form and legality, and that is exactly what we did. We did our jobs. And the chief deputy in charge of the contract section, he's been in our office for over 25 years. He has served through numerous attorneys general, all Republican, of course, because I'm the first Democrat, but he's there just to do his job. He reviewed that contract. We've reviewed it with him as well. And it was a constitutional violation. It was a violation of the State Gaming Act, in our opinion. And that's all it was, period. It was a constitutional review. It was review of the laws of Pennsylvania. We did our job. So anybody who cries a foul that it was politics, you know, I dismiss those criticisms. I believe that 3.1 million people elected me to this job because they know I don't play politics. They trust me to do my job, and that's exactly what I did.
How is all of this affecting your relationship with Governor Corbett?
It doesn't affect my relationship with him at all, to be quite honest with you. It's not personal to me. I have a job to do, and I do my job. And where that comes out, it comes out. It's really that simple. There are no, I don't believe that on my end anyway, there aren't any personalities involved. I just do my job. And sometimes I will agree with the governor. Sometimes I'll disagree. But I have a responsibility to the people of Pennsylvania to do my job, and I do.
Does he realize, do you feel that he realizes it's not personal?
Well, I don't know. You're going to have to ask him, I suppose.
If the governor chooses to pursue the lottery privatization further, are there things that he needs to do to make it more open and transparent? Certainly that's what some in the legislature have called for. How much of that concerns you as Attorney General?
That doesn't concern me at all, because that is not the scope of my review. I have to review the four corners of that contract that's submitted to us. Now, I understand that it will be resubmitted sometime in the first week of May, and I can guarantee that we will look at that contract as if it's a fresh contract. We will review it exactly the same manner as we did before. And, if it comes on to the point where it does not violate the state constitution or the gaming laws or indemnification or doesn't violate any other provisions, then it would be deemed acceptable by our office. If it does violate the constitution or the gaming laws or any other provision that we are responsible for protecting, then we'll do our job there as well. And I just want to make sure that it's understood that we do not have any personal stake. We do not set policy in our office. We don't review the contract, and we're not allowed to review the contract as to whether it sets good public policy. We review it as if it whether it violates state law or not. That's why we declined the contract the first time it was submitted to us.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane, and we're taking your email questions today at esspgh@wesa.fm. You can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. You are now weighing an issue perhaps more controversial than the ones we've discussed so far, and that's the state's voter ID law, which had its implementation delayed by Commonwealth Court, as you know. You criticized the law on the campaign trail, but the lawsuit challenging the voter ID law will be heard in July. As the state's chief legal and law enforcement officer, the attorney general would normally be in court to defend the law, which, of course, is one of the duties of your office. So what will you do here?
Well, that is correct. It is one of our duties to defend the state agencies and the law, and that is what the office has been doing and is continuing to do. My criticisms in the past were that it could not be implemented in a way that didn't discriminate against certain sections of the voters, and it could not guarantee that the voting rights of others would not be infringed upon. We have been reviewing this thoroughly, along with, you know, a lot of the other things that have been on our plate in the past 12 weeks. And I will tell you that I will come to a decision very soon because the trial is coming up. But I need to make sure that, number one, we do our job, but I do it in a way that is ethically responsible towards me as well as towards our client, who is the state agency that they have to defend, but also towards the people of Pennsylvania. You know, we're in a precarious predicament sometimes when our duties sometimes are parallel to each other, and sometimes they don't always mix. And that's when I have to decide what best serves the people of Pennsylvania, whether it would be me putting the case back into the general counsel's office or whether it would be me going ahead and defending the law as stated. So that's something that we're still reviewing, and we should come up with a decision very shortly.
I know that you can't let your personal feelings interfere with the duties that you must execute, but how difficult would it be for you to go into court and defend a law that you have criticized that many people feel is a political ruse?
Yeah. Well, I couldn't do it. I mean, quite honestly, we have an ethical duty and responsibility as an attorney. And as an attorney, and I don't ever submit my personal feelings upon anything. If it's my feelings as regard to the law and whether it fits in the law, then that's one thing as opposed to whether I like something or not. And when it comes to voter ID, I have been critical of the implementation process. And I believe that it is our responsibility to make sure that as many people who can vote, who are eligible to vote, are capable of doing so. It is one of our rights as citizens. So when you come to the question of whether you either defend a law that you believe is unconstitutional or whether then you have to make sure that someone else is responsible for defending it, it's a tough question. There's no doubt. But I think I'm pretty good at making tough decisions, and I hardly ever lose sleep over them. They're always well-informed, and I always take my time, talk to as many people as I possibly can, get as much information, and I'm always within the bounds of my ethical responsibilities and duties as Attorney General.
Is there anything that you've come across in your legal career that has left you maybe with one or two sleepless nights?
Never. I can honestly tell you that I have never had any regrets because it was never worth it to me to risk my career or to risk my ethics or my morals. If somebody ever asked me to do something along those lines, my answer would always be no. So I've never lost a night of sleep over something like that, and I never will.
Now, this is another one of those issues that puts you at odds with the governor. And you've said, I have to do what I have to do as part of my job as Attorney General. Nevertheless, how important is it, or how does it affect your ability to do your job? Can it be a hindrance if you're at odds with the governor on a number of really what for him are pet issues?
It is not a hindrance to me. I take each responsibility, each task, each matter, each case on an individual basis. It is not a totality of all of the cases in our office. We have a responsibility to take each case as if it's our one and only case. And I only look at that case, I first determine what our responsibilities are under the Commonwealth Attorneys Act, and then we just go about doing our job. It doesn't matter to me that, you know, I've been in conflict on five cases with the governor, and well, now I need to make sure that, you know, we're not in conflict on this one because of that. That is not the case. The case is that every single matter is handled within the confines of what our duties are. It's treated as if it's our only case in the office, and we make the best decision on that particular case that we can. Where it falls in the scheme of whether it's in conflict with one person or another, that isn't my concern.
And obviously, this is not unprecedented. When Governor Corbett was serving as Attorney General, he was a Republican in that office, serving for a Democratic governor, Ed Rendell, and oftentimes they disagreed on health care being one of the issues they disagreed upon. That having been said, have you ever received any kind of communication from anyone in the governor's office, hey, ease up, or, you know, we don't appreciate this, that kind of thing?
No, I haven't. I will say that I think their relationship is very professional between our offices. We have a respect for what the governor's office does. I believe they have a respect for what our office does, particularly from coming out of our office. And the relationship is not nearly as contentious as it may appear. We do our jobs. I'm quite sure that the governor's office does their job. Sometimes it will fall in line with each other's decisions. Sometimes it won't.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. Our guest is Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. We'll be taking your email questions at ESSPGH at WESA.FM. And you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at hashtag EPLive. And we'll continue with our one-on-one conversation with Attorney General Kathleen Kane when Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're devoting our entire program today to an interview with Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. And we're taking your email questions at ESSPGH at WESA.FM. And you can reach us on Twitter at ESSPGH and follow the conversation at hashtag EPLive. Attorney General Kane, you are just a few months into the job. 1 month into the job, you closed the Florida loophole on gun permits. What was behind your decision?
That's right. Well, there's been a problem in Pennsylvania for the past 11 years. The Florida Reciprocity Agreement was poorly drafted. And because of that, it created a loophole whereby Pennsylvania residents could apply to Florida for a Florida concealed carry permit. Florida would then grant those licenses based upon some differing criteria than Pennsylvania, and those Pennsylvanians then were allowed to carry a concealed weapon in Pennsylvania with the Florida carry permit. They usurped Pennsylvania law, and a lot of there were many occurrences where people who were denied licenses in Pennsylvania then went to Florida or other states and obtained a license. Now, if you live in Pennsylvania, you need to follow Pennsylvania law, whether it's gun laws or traffic laws or criminal laws, but you need to follow Pennsylvania law. So we realized that this was a time with the new administration that we can renegotiate the reciprocity agreement with Florida. And their response when we called to tell them that we wanted to talk to them about it was, what took you so long? You're only one of three states who still do it this way. So they were very great to deal with. We closed that loophole. So now if you are a Pennsylvania resident, you must carry a Pennsylvania concealed carry permit. If you are a Florida resident with a Florida permit, you are allowed to come into Pennsylvania and we will recognize your permit. So we still have the reciprocity. It does not affect the gun rights of those Pennsylvania people who carry Pennsylvania permits. It is only meant to target those who usurp Pennsylvania law. And since then, we have looked at all of our reciprocity agreements across the nation, and we have found that that also occurs in Virginia as well as Arizona. And just last week, I signed the renegotiated reciprocity with those two states to close their loopholes as well, and their loopholes were very similar to Florida.
Now, this is something you did 1 month into the job. Was this an area that you identified as something you really wanted to deal with right off the bat, or was there someone else behind it? How did that all come together so quickly?
I wanted to deal with it right off of the bat. In fact, I talked about it many times on the campaign trail because public safety is a big concern of mine. It is a passion. And everywhere I went, it was a passion for everyone else. The most basic function of our government is to protect our people and to protect our streets. And that was one common sense way of getting it done. And it was something that I, as the Attorney General, would have the authority to do. So immediately when I got into office, we started working on that. And in fact, some of the good people who were there beforehand knew that that was important to me, and they started working on it before I even got there. And then I was faced with the opportunity, do we want to go forward with it? And I think that that was a very simple and easy decision.
Why do you suppose it wasn't dealt with sooner?
Politics. I think because of politics. Years past, candidates or government officials couldn't even say the word gun in any public appearance, or they would be shunned by the NRA or gun lobbying groups, and they were afraid that they wouldn't win re-election. So politics, I think, played a huge role in it. But we can't play politics when it comes to protecting our kids and our neighborhoods and our schools. We cannot play politics. And this was just common sense. This isn't affecting anyone's right to own a gun or to buy a gun. This was just a common sense loophole that we closed, and it made it a little bit safer for everyone else.
Many, many of these kinds of laws that you are behind, people refer to as common sense gun laws. Many gun owners, though, and the NRA don't see it that way. And this is a state where the people that own guns love having their gun rights and are concerned about having them taken away and who do have a voice when it comes to politics. So even though you have said that you're not, that you can't play politics and you're not going to let that concern you, there will be another election for you to keep your job as Attorney General. How concerned are you about how that a decision like this to close the Florida loophole on gun permits will affect your efforts going forward?
Well, first, let me say I'm from the Northeast. I'm from Scranton. Many of my friends are police officers and hunters. I believe in gun rights, too. I mean, it's our Second Amendment. I believe in all of the amendments, and I strongly defend them. But I'm not concerned at all about my next election. And I think that's where the problem comes in when public servants are only concerned about their next election and they refuse to put the needs of the people that they represent, that they are chosen to lead, they refuse to put the needs of the people ahead of their own needs and their own desires for their next election. So I'm not concerned at all. I do my job right now, and if I don't win re-election in 4 years because of it, as long as I can turn around and say this state is a safer place because of the last 4 years, I will ride off into the sunset very happy and very proud of what I've done. But I don't think that's going to be the case, and here's why. There have been many studies done, recent studies that shown that even gun owners and even members of the NRA believe in background checks. And they believe in common sense approaches. You know, the 15% or the 20% that doesn't believe in them, yes, they're the loudest, but they don't represent the majority of the population. And most of those people who don't believe that we should have any more universal background checks or close loopholes, they don't understand what the law is. That's what the studies have shown. Half of them believe that we have laws that we don't actually have. And when they're confronted with the actual information and the facts, when they're shown that we don't have the laws that they think we have, then they believe that we should have these laws. So it is a misinformation. I think it's it points to the fact that sometimes interest groups put out their own information, disinformation, lies, and people believe it. And I think that that's sad. People really just want the facts, and they're smart enough to make their own decision. And those studies have shown that once they are given the facts, they do make their own decision, and their decision is to make sure that we are safer in this state and in this country.
Are there other gun ownership loopholes that you believe need to be closed in the state of Pennsylvania?
Sure. Now, Pennsylvania does have some good gun laws, but there are loopholes. So, for example, a federally licensed gun dealer has to do a background check, but yet the gun show down the street does not require them. That doesn't make any sense to me. If you're transferring a weapon, if you're selling a weapon, then it needs a background check. What is the difference between the gun show or the federally licensed dealer? There is none. We also have a loophole with not just with regard to location of purchasing, but also with regard to the type of weapon. So in Pennsylvania, you have to have a background check for handguns, but you don't for rifles. And rifles also qualify under as AR-15s and other assault weapons. So you don't have to have a background check. I don't understand the logic of that. They all shoot bullets. They all potentially kill innocent human beings. And in the wrong hands, they're all dangerous. So why not have a background check? And again, many gun owners and many NRA members believe that we want to keep guns in the hands of responsible citizens. And background checks make sure that it's not in the hands of irresponsible citizens. So people who are not qualified under federal and state statutes, who have a criminal record that disqualified them from owning a gun, or the mentally ill. And that's all that these background checks do. That is it. It does not affect your right to own a gun if you are legally capable of doing so.
What sort of gun control legislation would you like to see passed in Washington? I know, for example, that you came out in support of Senator Toomey's legislation that would have expanded background checks that was just defeated in the Senate yesterday. And he took a political risk by taking that position. You supported him.
I did support him because he is one of our leaders in this state. He is one of our senators. And I will tell you that I'm proud of what he did. He showed real leadership. And being a leader means showing courage and having responsibility to the people that you represent. And that's exactly what Senator Toomey did. He is making Pennsylvania, or he's attempting to make Pennsylvania and every other state a safer place. So he put his politics aside. That's all we want in this country. We want our leaders to represent us, not to represent their wallets or their campaign finance accounts or their next election. We want them to represent us, and that's what Senator Toomey did. And Senator Toomey's bill and Senator Manchin's bill was exactly along the lines of what we're talking about. It's uniform background checks. It's just making sure that it closes the loophole. And when we talk about misinformation that's given out or lies that's given out, there was a campaign by a gun lobbying group that said that this would not allow a transfer from a father to a son or a mother to a daughter. And that is not true. It was explicitly stated in that bill that family to family or family to friend transfers were excluded from this bill. All we were doing was making sure that the felons and the mentally ill did not get their hands on a gun. And I will tell you, I'm very disappointed, very sad that our leaders couldn't find it in themselves to look past themselves and to represent the kids and the mothers and the fathers and our older Pennsylvanians and our older Americans who have to walk down the streets in fear every day. That's not right.
And this legislation was a compromise of a compromise. The idea that there might ever be another assault weapons ban in the United States seems much farther away now than it did yesterday. Having said that, do we need another assault weapons ban? Do we need to bring that back?
I think let's start with step one. And first of all, I believe that this loss in the Senate is round one. And the fight is never over in round one unless there's a knockout, and this was not a knockout. So everyone will get back in the ring and continue moving forward because the people of the United States are not sitting back, and they're not going to allow our leaders to play politics any longer. The people are now standing up and speaking for themselves, and they can also do that in the next election. But let's start with the background checks, and let's make sure that all of the guns and all of the locations are covered under them, and let's see what happens from there. If we start with step one, then I think that people won't be as afraid. You know, there's been information or misinformation again that this country will be disarmed. That will never happen. It will never happen. No one believes that it should happen. And I believe that if we take it step by step, that they will feel more comfortable in the process, and they will know that no one's trying to take their gun away. No one. We're just trying to make sure that people are safe. That's all.
Our guest is Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. We have just a few minutes left and some other issues to cover. Attorney General Kane, I'm curious about your feelings about gay marriage. Pennsylvania has a Defense of Marriage Act. Do you think it's constitutional?
Well, right now that act is, or that, not our act, but the Defense of Marriage in general is before the United States Supreme Court. And we are going to anxiously await that decision to see where it leaves Pennsylvania and their act.
What are your priorities when it comes to handling street crime, child pornography, crimes against consumers, the things that you hope to accomplish in the months and years ahead?
They're all my priorities. We have put together an initiative called the Mobile Street Crimes Unit that is meant to be an on-the-ground force to hit these neighborhoods who have been hardest hit by crime, by gangs, by drugs. It'll be a comprehensive approach. It will involve the community. It will involve the schools. It will bring representatives from all over, from DEA, FBI. We have the chiefs of police who have signed on, as well as our state agents. And we will create a net. And you have to have that. And it's mobile in nature because we know that once we move them out of one area, they are going to move to another area, and we need to be able to pick up and move with them as well until they cross these borders, and it is no longer worthwhile doing business, selling drugs, having gangs in Pennsylvania. That is going to take an initiative. We have set it forth before the General Assembly, and we are really hoping that they are going to back us. I know we have very strong support from a lot of members, and we have strong support from the community. It's desperately needed. I'll tell you a quick story. When I took office, in my inauguration speech, I said, "We are coming to your neighborhoods. We are coming to help." People feel like they've been forgotten and no one cares. The very next morning, a young woman called our office and said, "I saw it on PCN. I hope she means what she says because we need it." This young woman was shot in the face and the back while she was 6 months pregnant in Pennsylvania. So there are stories like that all over the place. I promise that we are coming to their neighborhoods to help. And I also let those who are on the wrong side of the law know that we are coming for them as well.
What are the most difficult cases to prosecute?
By far, child sexual assault cases, because they involve a child, and exploitation of the elderly. It's just so sad to watch. Sometimes elderly people are bilked out of their very last dime. They deserve so much better than that. We have a very aggressive consumer protection program, as well as outreach and education program to reach our older Pennsylvanians. I'm going to Scam Jam in Philadelphia coming up shortly, and it's a gathering many older Pennsylvanians, and senior centers are bringing a lot of their people, and we're going to teach them about how to avoid being a victim, and if they suspect that they are, how to get the help. But we have a lot of initiatives as well with our Child Predator Unit. There are 2,800 identified child predators in Pennsylvania. And in my 12 weeks in office, we have made 16 arrests as compared to 19 of all of last year. So we have updated software. I have hired a nationally renowned expert in the field of child predators, and he is running our unit. We are bringing the software that we need to identify and to protect our kids and to make sure that we pick up these travelers before they reach our children.
We have about 30 seconds left, so the last question, a fill-in-the-blank question. You will know you have been successful as Pennsylvania Attorney General if you accomplish blank.
All of the above. I set my standards high.
Why not? Simple as that.
Simple as that.
Our guest has been Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane, and we have covered a wide range of issues during the course of the last hour. I know that you're busy, and I know that you do very few of these interviews. This is your first time doing a radio interview, so we are flattered that you chose to do it with us.
Well, thank you. You have a great reputation, and I like the way that you put the facts out to the public. I admire that.
Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane has been my guest. Again, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Paul.
Tomorrow, Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey discusses his failed gun control legislation and where things go from here. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening.